Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And first of all, today I'd like to thank you for all the people that have shown support for Exploration and also bought a copy of my latest book, The Future of Humanity, Our Destiny in the Universe. It's now a New York Times bestseller. In fact, it's my fourth New York Times bestseller. And if you want to find out more about my previous works, go to my website at mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Well, you can imagine I've gotten a ton of email and comments concerning that book. So in the first half of Exploration, I'm going to try to answer some of these questions, such as, the space program, isn't it a waste of money? I mean, colonizing Mars? I mean, come on, give me a break. That would bankrupt the planet Earth. And isn't outer space dangerous and, for the most part, rather useless? Well, I try to answer all these questions one by one in the first half of Exploration. The first question that I often get is the space program. Isn't it a waste of money? I mean, after all, rockets are very expensive. And second of all, don't we need the money for the planet Earth to stimulate economic growth, reduce income inequality, get the economy going? Isn't that where the money should go? Well, you see, personally, I think we shouldn't pit the two against each other, because believe it or not, a good chunk of the world economy is done in outer space. Chances are, if you buy something, especially online, if you send an email, if you check the weather report, if you check what's happening in finances around the world, chances are that information went up into outer space to satellites, hundreds of satellites orbiting the planet Earth, giving you instantaneous information and also facilitating the economy. The point is that much of the world economy is done in outer space. If we were to somehow shut down outer space, all the satellites in the space program, the world economy would be plunged into a deep recession, if not a depression. That's how dependent we are on the outer space. In fact, chances are, if you're listening to the sound of my voice, chances are some of you got a compliment of the space program. And also, I remember years ago, President Lyndon Baines Johnson got a heap of criticism for funding the Tyros weather satellite. You see, people said, we don't need a weather satellite. If you want to know what the weather is like, lick your finger, point it in the sky, and bingo, you know which way the wind is blowing. So who needs a $1 billion weather satellite? Well, I still remember LBJ was supposed to come on TV to defend things like the Tyros weather satellite. And then, from outer space, for the first time in world history, a satellite photographed a monster hurricane headed toward the great state of Texas. Fortunately, we were able to give ample warning. Thousands of lives were saved. Hundreds of millions of dollars in property damage was averted because of this early warning given to us for the first time in world history when we photographed a live hurricane from outer space. Well, I still remember President LBJ came on the evening news and he announced that today the space program has paid for itself. Actually, that's not quite right. You see, the space program more than paid for itself. I mean, think of the lives that were saved. Think of all the future hurricanes and weather anomalies that could be predicted using our so-called useless weather satellites. So simply poking your finger into the wind is simply not enough. And then people say, well, isn't it expensive? I mean, after all, it costs $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit around the planet Earth. That's your weight in gold. Think of your weight made out of solid gold. That's what it costs to put you just in near-Earth orbit. Forget going to the moon. That's going to cost about $100,000 a pound. And for that matter, going to Mars would cost about $1 million a pound. And so isn't the space program too expensive? I mean, in 1966, at the height of the Cold War and the space race, the NASA budget consumed 5% of every dollar in the federal budget. That's amazing. When you pay your income tax, 5% of every dollar you sent to Washington actually went to the Apollo space program. Well, as you can imagine, that was unsustainable, and it eventually collapsed. So we went to the moon 50 years ago and never went back. Well, now prices are plummeting. New money is coming in. Silicon Valley billionaires are opening up their checkbooks. And President Barack Obama helped us stimulate that by encouraging private enterprise to go into outer space. Why should the taxpayer have to sustain the burden of the space program when private enterprise can reduce costs, increase efficiency, and help to pay for some of the budget? Well, you probably saw the movie The Martian, starring Matt Damon. Great movie. Well, that movie cost $100 million. But you see, the Indian government sent a probe to Mars for $70 million. So, in other words, a Hollywood movie about going to Mars costs more than actually going to Mars. Now, you may say to yourself, well, yeah, Silicon Valley billionaires are opening up their checkbooks and bankrolling a fleet of rockets. However, it's all capitalism. I mean, they're doing it for greed. They want to squeeze dollars out of this space program. What do you think about that? Well, first of all, let me say that it was President Barack Obama who opened the door. He, first of all, canceled the space shuttle program. So you're not going to find Bruce Willis shooting down asteroids from outer space. President Barack Obama canceled the space shuttle program. He canceled the replacement for the space shuttle program called the Constellation. He canceled the moon program, and he canceled the Mars program. In its place, he said he would want to rely on private enterprise, that is, a union of public and private funds. Well, along comes Elon Musk of SpaceX and Tesla Motors and PayPal. Along comes the founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos. They've opened up their checkbooks, but it was not all for greed. First of all, let's be honest, they are capitalists. They're not doing this for their health. They have a hidden agenda. But that hidden agenda is actually not so hidden. Elon Musk has stated that he's doing it because he wants to create a multi-planet species. That is, when he was a child, he read Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, as I did when I was a child, and he dreamed of one day civilization would spread into outer space. And Jeff Bezos, well, he was a fan of Star Trek. And he wants to create a new vision. He wants to make the Earth into a garden so that all the heavy industry, the pollution would be done in outer space so that the Earth would become a jewel. It would become a conservation paradise. It would become this garden in outer space. And these billionaires are just not talking about it. It's just not ego. They're putting down the bucks. Elon Musk is pushing forth the Falcon Heavy rocket, which already has been tested, fully capable of going to the moon. And he's also promoting the BFR rocket. And the BFR rocket is fully capable of going to Mars one day. And then Jeff Bezos, not to be outdone, he has his Blue Origin rocket series in Texas. He has his own launch pad. He doesn't go to Cape Canaveral. He doesn't have to. He has his own spaceport in Texas, funded by some of the proceeds from Amazon. And not to be outdone, the Chinese are not too far behind. They've announced that they're going to set up a settlement on the moon, toward the southern part of the moon, they announced. And yes, they plan to put the Chinese flag on the moon. So in other words, we could have a traffic jam around the moon with NASA, with the SLS booster rocket, with Elon Musk, with the Falcon Heavy booster rocket, with Jeff Bezos of the new Armstrong booster rocket. the Chinese with the Long March booster rocket, plus the Europeans and the Japanese and the Indians. They've also said some veiled comments about perhaps they too would want to go into outer space once again after a 50-year gap. And then the next question is, well, I mean, the cost of this is going to be great. Yeah, Silicon Valley billionaires are helping to defray the cost, but what about really dramatically reducing the cost? Well, let's do a thought experiment. If you get into your car and you commute to work, do you junk your car after just one trip? No, that would bankrupt your economy if you had to junk your car after just one trip. The United States economy couldn't survive that if everyone junked their car after just one trip. But that's what we do in the space program. We junk our rockets after just one use. And that's where the reusable rocket comes into the picture. So some people think that we could reduce the cost by a factor of 10, maybe 100, if we reuse the booster rocket. And sure enough, Elon Musk and also Jeff Bezos have pioneered the reusable rocket, fully capable of being used more than once. And so we don't have to junk our rockets just after one use. And then the next question is, well, the moon is kind of far away, but there's nothing valuable on the moon. We're not going to really mine the moon. So let's get into the geology of the moon. First of all, the moon is about 3 days away. That's a hop, skip, and a jump when you look at the space program. 3 days away by rocket. And prices are dropping. In fact, Elon Musk is even selling tickets to go to the moon on his Falcon Heavy or the BFR rocket. In fact, a Japanese billionaire has already bought out the rocket. And this Japanese billionaire fully wants to be the first tourist to go orbiting around the moon. Personally, I think that the moon could eventually become a tourist attraction. I think our grandkids may have the opportunity to even honeymoon on the moon. But let's face it, mining the moon is not economically viable. For the simple reason is that the moon is basically made out of Earth material. The chemical composition of the moon and the Earth are almost identical. We know that because we have lots of moon rocks that our astronauts salvaged from the moon. So why bother to dig for iron, let's say, when you can just dig in your own backyard? You don't have to go to the moon to get valuable ores. However, the asteroid belt does beckon, and this is now where Google billionaires are jumping into the picture. They're not content to let Elon Musk of SpaceX and Tesla or Jeff Bezos of Amazon get all the headlines. Google now wants to come in to mine the asteroids for platinum and heavy rare earth elements. So let me explain. When the Earth was molten billions of years ago, heavy elements like platinum, rare earth, sunk to the center of this molten mass of rock and lava. And that's why we don't see that much platinum and these heavy elements on the surface, the crust of the Earth. But asteroids represent a failed planet between Mars and Jupiter. Their chemical composition is quite different, because they didn't go through that process. And therefore, if you bring back an asteroid, yes, you could potentially harvest billions, maybe hundreds of billions, in rare earth elements and platinum. Realize that the Chinese set off a near panic several years ago when they decided to basically, in effect, shut down the supply of rare earth elements. Over 90% of rare earth elements for Silicon Valley comes from China. And China has basically a stranglehold on this extremely valuable commodity, rare earth elements. But they're found in asteroids. And so that's why Google is now entering the picture. And then, of course, if you watch science fiction, you read about going to Mars. Well, there are pluses and minuses about going to Mars. As one anchorman said on TV, it's just rocks. I mean, what are we going to find on Mars? Rocks. Rocks and more rocks. Well, that's a cynical point of view, but of course that is a legitimate point of view because, well, the early pioneers that settled into vast areas of the planet Earth, Well, they didn't have to worry about oxygen. They didn't have to worry about water so much. They could harvest plants. They could kill game. So there was something to live off the land with. But you see, Mars has no oxygen atmosphere. It's cold, freezing cold. You're not going to find animals that you can shoot. You're not going to find crops that you can harvest. If you saw the movie The Martian, you know that you have to basically start from scratch. First of all, why even bother? Well, you see, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why they're not here today to talk about it. There are no dinosaurs in this room here in Manhattan because of the fact that, well, yeah, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. We do, and we have a chance to escape Armageddon, which will one day inevitably affect the Earth. Let's be blunt about this. Life on Earth is eventually going to get destroyed, not anytime soon, but in a 5 billion-year time frame, the sun will eat up the Earth. The poets ask the question, how will the Earth die, in fire or ice? Well, physics gives us a death warrant. Physics says fire, because in 5 billion years, the sun will expand so that the sky will be on fire. From sunset to sunrise, the skies will be on fire. The sun will expand, the mountains will melt, the oceans will boil, and we will have the last nice day. We're going to go back into the sun. That's a law of physics. The sun will consume its hydrogen gas, consume helium, and expand and eat up the Earth, including Mercury, Venus, and parts of Mars as well. Now, on a scale of 50 million years, we have to worry about planet killers. That is, asteroids and comets like the one that hit Mexico 65 million years ago, wiping out the dinosaurs. In fact, every century, city busters hit the planet Earth. Three of them were aimed at Russia. We had the Tunguska impact around the turn of the last century. We had the Chelyabinsk meteor that sailed over Russia in 2013. And just recently, we had another meteor that exploded near Russia with the force of 10 Hiroshima bombs. So we now realize that these things are much more common than we previously thought. We've been blissfully unaware of the fact that the Earth lives in a swarm of rocks, meteors, some of them so big, they are planet busters. They could literally wipe out life on the planet Earth. And, of course, realize that this is not just science fiction, because about 75,000 years ago, something happened that almost killed off all humans on the planet Earth. Did you know that if you talk to your next-door neighbor and genetically analyze their genes, we find that we are almost clones of each other compared to animals? If you take two dogs, two cats at random, they are genetically quite dissimilar. But humans are almost twins of each other, believe it or not. You may find this hard to believe. But yes, genetically speaking, our genes are almost identical. So in other words, something happened about 75,000 years ago to kill off our ancestors so that only a handful of us survived. How many of us? You can calculate that mathematically. A few hundred to maybe 1,000 of us survived a cataclysm 75,000 years ago. What happened 75,000 years ago? Well, we don't know. This is controversial, but some geologists point out that Mount Toba in Indonesia blew up 75,000 years ago, a gigantic supervolcano eruption that wiped out many life forms in Asia and in Africa. So some people think, aha, that's what caused the fact that only a few hundred of us escaped to repopulate the entire planet Earth. Amazing. We are literally all brothers and sisters on the planet Earth, descendants of maybe a few hundred Adams and a few hundred Eves that luckily survived that cataclysm. Could it happen again? Well, it will. Right in the middle of America, we have the Yellowstone National Park. But you see, the Yellowstone National Park is famous not just for Yogi Bear. It's also famous for the super volcano that lurks underneath the hot springs, fully capable of ripping the guts out of the United States of America. Geologically speaking, that's how North America will perish, when the supervolcano inevitably blows up. Well, in addition to that, we have, of course, self-inflicted crises. We have nuclear proliferation. We have designer weaponized germs. We have, of course, the greenhouse effect. And so we have all these things that could literally wipe out life on the planet Earth. Now, if you're a science fiction fan, you dream about the fact that maybe they will create a space ark, that'll take us to Mars or wherever. Well, a space ark would bankrupt the world economy. However, a settlement that is self-sustaining, that has its own agriculture, that has its own supply and demand, a settlement on Mars that's self-sufficient is fully possible. In fact, President Barack Obama said that by the 2030s, he expected to see humans walking on the surface of Mars. And so we're talking about the fact that it is technically possible, still expensive, but technically possible to start a settlement on Mars. In other words, an insurance policy. No one is saying that we should bankrupt the planet Earth to create a cockamamie Mars base just for the hell of it. No. We're talking about an insurance policy, just in case something bad does happen on the planet Earth, that it's worthwhile to create a self-sustaining settlement. It'll be done in stages. It'll take time. But it'll be self-sustaining. It's not going to need an umbilical cord to feed it funds from the planet Earth. So first of all, you would have to mine the ice. Ice is plentiful on Mars. Ice can be melted to extract drinking water, also oxygen and hydrogen for rocket fuel and for breathing, then solar panels for energy. And then if you could raise the temperature of Mars by 6 degrees, you set off a greenhouse effect, a runaway greenhouse effect on Mars. If you can raise the temperature of Mars by 6 degrees. Now, how would you do that? Well, satellites, already we know, can beam microwave sun energy back down to the polar ice caps. You see, Mars has plenty of water. It's all frozen. But Mars once had a great ocean, about the size of the United States. It had lakes, rivers. It had flowing rivers on the surface of Mars, but all that's gone. But the water is mainly there in the ice caps. And so by having solar satellites melt the ice caps, then it may be possible to let water flow freely on the surface of Mars once again, to create a self-sustaining settlement on that planet. And then further out, some dreamers from NASA have even looked even beyond that. We're not talking, of course, maybe in 100 years, but Titan, a moon of Saturn, has an atmosphere made out of methane and ethane. In other words, rocket fuel. We have a ready-made gas station in outer space. This is amazing. You can literally refuel your rockets by going to a moon of Saturn and, as a consequence, cut down the cost of exploring beyond Jupiter and Saturn. And then beyond that, my colleague Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, had a plan to send a postage stamp chip to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star. This could be done with off-the-shelf technology. We don't need new booster rockets. We just need a bank of laser beams that'll fire energy onto a chip that is suspended by a parachute. By inflating the parachute, the laser beam can hurl this chip to 20% the speed of light, and in 20 years, it'll reach Alpha Centauri. So in other words, the first starship is actually possible in this century. And guess who's funding that? Well, once again, another billionaire. And so you see, these billionaires are just not doing it to line their pockets with greed and with avarice and with profit. No, these people, some of them had scientific backgrounds when they were young, and they want to relive the dream of one day going to the stars. And beyond that, every Trekkie wants to know about, well, about warp drive. Well, recently, we physicists have been able to photograph a black hole, the shadow, the silhouette of a black hole in outer space, about 55 million light years from the planet Earth. It weighs 6.5 billion times the mass of our sun. It is a black hole so monstrous that it could eat up the sun and not even burp. But what lies at the center of that black hole? Well, we don't know. But if you take Einstein's equations and start with a spinning black hole, everyone forgets this. Black holes spin very rapidly. They collapse not to a dot, which is what most textbooks say. No. They collapse to a ring of neutrons. A ring of neutrons spinning so fast that centrifugal force prevents it from collapsing. And if you go through the ring, you don't necessarily die. The Riemann curvature tensor is actually finite at the center of the ring. Just like Alice putting her hand through the looking glass, you wind up on the other side of forever. This is a wormhole. And who introduced the concept of wormholes? Einstein himself, in 1935, wrote the first paper about a wormhole, a gateway, a tunnel through the fabric of space and time. Now, what's the catch? There's always a catch someplace, right? Well, first of all, you need fantastic amounts of energy to open up the gateway. You need a black hole, something that we cannot manipulate for centuries to come. Then you need negative energy, an exotic form of energy to stabilize it so it doesn't collapse on you as you enter the black hole. And if you saw in the movie Interstellar, the guys who helped to give scientific authenticity to that movie, one of them was a Nobel Prize winner in physics, Kip Thorne. And so you realize that, yes, we physicists take this seriously, that these are solutions of Einstein's equations. We don't know whether they're real or not. It's still pure speculation. But the mathematics seems to indicate that there could be another side of a black hole, maybe a white hole, maybe a white hole where matter falls in and then spews out the other end. And in fact, some of my colleagues have even said that maybe that's the Big Bang, that maybe the Big Bang is a white hole where matter from stars that have collapsed spew out the other end, creating perhaps another Big Bang, creating another universe. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And then in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on our special guest, astronaut Tom Jones. He's someone who's actually been in outer space, and we'll talk about the joy, the dangers, and the promise of going into outer space. This interview was pre-recorded. And once again, we are going to talk about one day, perhaps we'll go to Mars. Perhaps we'll go even beyond that. But what are the dangers, risks, and some of the costs involved in that process? So once again, our special guest today is Tom Jones, astronaut. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we discussed briefly my book, The Future of Humanity, Our Destiny in the Universe. It's a New York Times bestseller. talking about, well, one day we're going to go into outer space. But what about the dangers? What about the cost? And what about the thrill of going into outer space? So with us today in the second half of the program, we're going to bring on once again astronaut Tom Jones. He's a man who's been up there. He's been in outer space, and he'll talk to us about his sensations, his feelings, the promise, and the perils of one day exploring the universe. And as we mentioned before, well, the bottom line is the dinosaurs did not have a space program. That's why they're not here today. Now, that doesn't mean we have to have a crash program and bankrupt the country. No, but we are talking about one day as prices keep dropping and as it gets easier and easier for public and private funds to go into space, that one day we may become a multi-planet species. So once again, our special guest today is astronaut Tom Jones. The first question for you, Dr. Jones, is as a youth, how did you first get interested in exploration and the space program?
It's easy to remember for me. My grandmother was a big reader, and so she went down to the five and dime store and bought on the remnant table a book called Space Flight, The Coming Exploration of the Universe. It was one of these little golden books of knowledge that you could get back in the 1960s. And so I was five, and she gave me this book, and it was filled with wonderful illustrations, paintings of what space flight might be like. There were no photos because no one had gone into space yet, but that really captured my imagination. These astronauts and spaceships were fascinating subjects to me, so I began to read more about those on trips to the library and very quickly got fascinated with the subject of space science and astronomy. When I was 12, my parents got our family our first telescope, and I became the sole operator of it. It was tough to get other people to let other people use it, but I had it out a lot in suburban Baltimore. And along with the fact that they were building rockets in my hometown as part of the Gemini program in the middle 60s, I think all of these things combined to make astronautics and astronomy a very favorite subject of mine, which I just devoured in school and at the library.
And you went to the United States Air Force Academy. Why'd you go there, and did you have in the back of your mind this career path that would take you into outer space?
Well, certainly by the age of 10, I was aware of the job of astronauts and the fact that it was a reality and that they were building rockets in my hometown. And I said, well, I'd like to ride a machine like that someday. And during the Apollo program, as we watched the first run-ups to the moon landings, I was aware that test pilots were the ones who were selected to be astronauts. So if I wanted to do the job, I certainly had to become a test pilot. And you've got to go through a military flight training program. And I chose the Air Force. So the Air Force Academy seemed to me the best place that was focused on flying in the country. And that's why I tried to enroll there. By the time I was in college, the moon landings were just finishing. And so it was very clear that I still wanted to do this, and I thought that was a great jump on the program, getting into flight school, becoming an Air Force pilot, and then becoming a test pilot.
And I understand that you flew missions on B-52 bombers for the Strategic Air Command. Could you elaborate?
Well, after a year of pilot training after graduation, I got a basic science degree at the Air Force Academy. I knew I was going to be flying for a while and then try to get into test pilot school. So my first assignment after pilot training was to go to Strategic Air Command, which was an outfit that was involved in nuclear deterrence. And my mission as a B-52 crew member, a co-pilot, and then an aircraft commander, was to sit alert duty out at the base about once every 3 weeks. I would live for an entire week out at the base trying to make sure that the Russians would always fear a counterattack if they tried to do a surprise attack on the U.S. So we trained for the nuclear delivery mission, a doomsday mission. And it was quite a strange existence. Every third week, you'd be waiting for the horn to blow, signaling a Russian attack, and then you'd jump into your planes and taxi out as fast as you could and take off. That's what we trained for. And fortunately, nobody ever shot at me, and the Cold War wound down to its eventual conclusion. While I was doing that, though, NASA brought along the space shuttle and changed the rules on how you could become an astronaut.
Now, many people who watched the movie, Top Gun with Tom Cruise, have dreamed about dogfights up there in the wild blue yonder. However, you went for a PhD in planetary sciences. So how did that come about?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was in the Air Force and sitting alert duty, and I remember clearly being out there on the base during one of those weeks of duty and watching the miniseries Cosmos by Carl Sagan. And this was a man and a television production that really captured my imagination. I said, here's a guy who's doing this for a career, the thing that I've loved to study and read about all these years. And now that NASA is looking for scientists and engineers, maybe I can become a space scientist, and maybe that would be an alternate path. I knew that test piloting would be a tough assignment to get. It was very competitive in the Air Force, and especially for bomber pilots who weren't widely needed at that time. So after watching Cosmos and reading some more books about that particular profession, I decided I'd go back to graduate school and see if I could become a practicing research scientist.
Now, a lot of people ask the question, if I want to become an astronaut, what do I do? Do I send a postcard to NASA saying, sign me up? What is the career path? What is the process by which somebody out there can realize a dream of going into outer space?
Well, it's easier today with the Internet. You can get on the Internet and read all about astronaut selection at NASA.gov, NASA.gov, their website, and search for astronaut selection. But back then, you just wrote a letter to the Johnson Space Center in Houston where the astronauts train, and I got a reply back from the selection office, and they informed me about the basic qualifications. You have to send in an application, which includes a big civil service exam and a lot of paperwork to fill out, as well as a medical exam. And you just send in that application, they keep it on file, and then every time that they select a new group of astronauts, they'll notify you to see whether you're still interested in applying. And so I started that process in 1986.
Now, 1986 was also a watershed year, because that's when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up on international television, a very sobering event. Seven astronauts tragically lost their lives in that accident. And we sometimes forget that going into outer space is not a Sunday picnic, that about 1% of the time there is booster rocket failure and major malfunction of rockets. So was that sobering? How did that impact on you?
Oh, it was terrible. I was watching that accident. I was watching with the launch of that mission with Krista McAuliffe, the first school teacher to go into space, with a bunch of school students, elementary school students at the University of Arizona, where I was a graduate student. And the catastrophe unfolded before us on this big screen TV. And, you know, you had to try to make some sense of it for the kids and tell the kids that there was no hope that they'd gotten out. And it was a terrible emotional blow. Next door at the Lunar and Planetary Lab where I was studying, everyone was completely floored, devastated by this emotionally. Even though most of the people were involved in planetary science and astronomy and robotic missions, they knew how serious this was for the future of space travel and exploration in general. So it was a real body blow. I had met the commander of that mission about a year before, and he'd encouraged me to apply to become an astronaut. He was a very motivated guy who was clear about his mission. And it was infectious. It motivated me to follow in his footsteps. And after his death, Dick Scobee, I decided that, well, he must have really believed in this to risk his life in such a way. And I knew that my desire to do it was very strong. And I thought if people like that that I look up to are willing to risk their lives, then I still think I could find the courage to do the same thing. And I talked it over with my wife before I began applying.
Now, you're a former test pilot, and you know when you go into that cockpit that you're putting your life on the line. You know that unlike a civilian, which wants lots of life insurance and assurances, there's no problem. You know you're putting your life on the line when you go into a jet airplane. Now, when you become an astronaut, are the astronauts also told the same thing? We have civilians going into outer space. We have politicians and multimillionaires now going into outer space. Are they really mentally prepared for the fact that, well, like I mentioned, roughly 1% of the time there is catastrophic failure?
Well, we're certainly aware of the risks. As a pilot, I didn't become a test pilot. I actually left the Air Force after just flying bombers because I wanted to pursue the science path. But I knew that the professionals involved in flying the shuttle were aware of the risks. Of course, Scobee certainly was. And I decided that there must be a recognition among all the crew members that what they're doing must register on them as being so worthwhile that they're willing to risk their physical safety, even their lives, to accomplish these missions. And when I got into the Astronaut Corps in 1990, I found that to be true, that people were thinking of this as a long-term program of exploration. They figured that the benefits they'd bring back from each mission would be building blocks that future explorers would use to return to the moon, get to the asteroids and Mars. So we all viewed this as a continuum, and each little contribution that we made was worth the risk of our lives. Now, the shuttle's a pretty safe machine, even though it's had two terrible accidents. It's one of the most reliable rockets that's out there. So you can always tell yourself that it's not going to happen to you, but you must recognize that it's a finite possibility that each mission has got, you know, one in a couple of hundred chances of leading to a catastrophe.
Okay, now let's get into the guts of your book. That is the training of an astronaut and what it's like there to orbit the Earth and look down from outer space. First of all, the training. Let's talk about going into swimming pools, going into 1,000 horsepower centrifuges, going into the Vomit Comet. What is the grueling regimen that astronaut training entails?
Well, to begin with, it's much like a college curriculum of investigating the basics of spaceflight. So you bring in all these people who are test pilots and scientists and engineers, and they have varied backgrounds, but everyone's capable of learning. And so essentially it's a graduate course in spaceflight and its fundamentals and the systems that allow us to survive and work up there, the space shuttle in this case. So it's a year of astronaut basic training. And you start in a classroom, read a lot of books, get a lot of lectures. So that's very familiar to most of us. And yet it moves very quickly into simulator training, where you're actually flipping switches, reading checklists, working as a team to put into practice what you've learned in the classroom. And there are also a lot of ancillary training experiences that are quite fun, even though they're very serious in mind, like survival training. What do you do if you bail out of a jet or out of a shuttle and you come down in some distant location where you've got to await rescue? So we had water and land survival training. We also, as you say, rode the centrifuge to prepare us for the accelerations of launch, scuba training to prepare us for underwater training in a spacesuit to simulate free fall, and finally that ride on the Vomit Comet that everybody looks forward to, where you get 20-second doses of free fall as the airplane rides this roller coaster path through the sky. And that's both exuberant and exhilarating, and then finally in the end it's an endurance contest to see if you can keep your stomach and your mind together while this airplane does these gyrations. But it's great to experience free fall.
Now, people who saw the movie Apollo 13 saw Tom Hanks floating for what seemed like forever. And people said, well, how'd they do that? There's no room for wires in that tiny little capsule. How'd they get Tom Hanks to float like that? And as you mentioned, it was this airplane called the Vomit Comet. And there's a reason for that. People throw up. Is that right?
Well, some do. Most people get a little queasy after the end of an hour and a half on that plane, where you do 40 up and down roller coaster cycles to give you those cycles of weightlessness that last 20 or 25 seconds. It's very aggravating to be in free fall for 25 seconds and then be slammed to the floor with two times the force of gravity as you pull out. And when you do that over and over, it tends to tumble your gyros and lead to nausea. I found that I never really got aggressively sick up there, but I certainly felt after the end of those 40 parabolas that I was ready to walk wobbly off the airplane and go sit down quietly for a while.
And let's talk about weightlessness. Weightlessness is the state of free fall. That is, if you're in an elevator and someone cuts the wire of the elevator, God forbid, you are in free fall and you are weightless because the floor of the elevator falls at the same rate that you do, giving you the illusion that there's no gravity. Of course, there's gravity. It's pulling you to the floor, but the floor is falling at the same rate as you. Same thing with the Vomit Comet. You're essentially being hurled like a rock into the atmosphere, and you are in free fall. So the question is, if you're in free fall, that sensation is a sensation of dying. That is, you're falling off a skyscraper. So is that the sensation that you have, that you're thrown like a rock into the atmosphere in the Vomit Comet? Is a sensation like the sensation that you're dying?
Well, fortunately, your body is pretty easily fooled. Your mind is fooled because you're in a cabin of an aircraft or you're in the cabin of a space shuttle, and you can't tell that you're being hurtled through the atmosphere or around a planet at hundreds or thousands of miles per hour as you fall, either on this roller coaster parabola or, you know, in an orbit around the Earth. So to you, your surroundings are falling with you. They all appear motionless. That's your frame of reference. And so you just appear to be floating. And so it's rather a gentle feeling. You don't feel any motion of high speed or even standing on the edge of a precipice and leaping off. So it's pretty easy to get used to. It's just a gentle lifting or a floating feeling. And it's nice to be able to move with just a fingertip push against the walls. And I find it's something that you actually forget about after a couple of days.
Now, you spent 52 days in Earth orbit during the 11 years you were in the astronaut program. So everyone wants to know, if you're up there for not just 20 seconds, but for days on end, how do you do very simple bodily functions, like, for example, eating? How do you eat when your food floats in front of you? How do you drink if water will simply float to the ceiling? And what the question everyone wants to know is, how do you go to the bathroom?
Well, all of those subjects I try to explore in skywalking to give you that personal experience of being in there. The eating, fortunately, is almost a non-issue. All of your swallowing and digestive functions seem to work just fine with the peristalsis that moves things through your digestive tract at work. Doesn't need gravity to function. You do have to eat these foods out of a pouch and drink liquids from a pouch with a straw inserted so that food and debris and globules of liquid don't float around the cabin and mess up the systems up there. So it's rather tedious after a while that you have to eat one package at a time. You don't get to sample three or four dishes at once. You've got to eat in a serial fashion, and it almost becomes perfunctory after a week of the novelty wearing off. So, but it's aside from a little bit of extra time and care required, it's actually quite easy to eat and drink. And I still enjoy the varied menu that we had available to us. Even though the foods aren't fresh, they're at least freeze-dried or irradiated or thermostabilized, so they retain some good flavors. Now, the bathroom question, down here on the ground, gravity makes everything go where it's supposed to. And as I write in the pages of Skywalking up there, you've got some special training to use because we use air instead of gravity to make things go where they're supposed to. Liquid down a suction hose where each crew member uses a personal funnel to guide the liquid into the tube. And for solid waste, it's blown into a storage tank underneath the commode seat. And then the clever thing about it is that the solid waste tank, while it's not in use, is exposed to a vacuum. So the solid waste is sterilized and dehydrated. So the next time it's used, there's no odor or chance of a pathogen getting back into the cabin. It's quite clever. And while it takes longer to use the system than on Earth, it actually functions quite well.
Well, according to the book, The Right Stuff, by Tom Wolfe, when our first astronaut, Alan Shepard, was sent into a suborbital trajectory, he had to go to the bathroom. He told Mission Control he had to go to the bathroom, and Mission Control vetoed it. And so they sent him into outer space, where he essentially urinated in outer space. Now, that is not a good thing to do, right? Because if you have liquid inside your spacesuit and you are weightless, it could be a mess, right?
Well, it certainly was a mess, and I'm sure he was quite a smelly guy when he came back and got out of the suit. But he survived just fine, and that's because of spacesuit design. They don't put any electronics generally inside an oxygen-filled suit unless there be an ignition source that could lead to a fire. So the inside of a spacesuit tends to be a quite benign place, and the liquid was just a little bit of mess. Fortunately, on the space shuttle, we deal with free fall inside a spacesuit by using diapers, large, absorbent, adult-sized diapers that can take care of that eventuality. And, you know, the space shuttle itself, you know, provides a means to get out of the suit right after you arrive in orbit, and you don't have to put the suit back on until reentry. So then you can use the bathroom facilities that we just discussed. So we're a long way from the right stuff now, and people seem to be able to deal with this quite easily.
Okay. Now, what is it like spiritually and emotionally to be in orbit, to look down on the planet Earth as you are in a spacewalk, suspended, orbiting the Earth, suspended in mid-flight with this little cable that connects you to the mother craft? What is it like to look back at the Earth?
Well, Michio, this was a great experience. I had been dreaming about spaceflight since I was 10. And here I was, 39 years old, on my first mission. And as I write in Skywalking, I got to orbit. I was so busy with my initial jobs that it was about an hour before I actually had a moment to look out the window. And I'll never forget that first impression of the Earth. I was looking out on the night side of Earth, and instead of stars, I saw this big round space or gap where stars should have been. That was the dark side of our planet. But on the very edge, the limb of the Earth, was a gentle band of robin's egg blue light that was growing in intensity and widening along the horizon of the Earth, and that was the coming sunrise. And this beautiful, delicate blue, and the fact that I was finally looking back at my planet after waiting for almost three decades to get there, brought tears to my eyes with the realization that I had finally arrived at that moment in time and space. And, you know, they were tears of gratitude to God for sending me up there and giving me the chance to do this, and they were just tears of appreciation at the beauty that I was seeing. And throughout my experiences in space on the other three missions I flew, the view of the Earth never became boring, or I never became blasé about it. It was always riveting. I had to tear myself away from the windows to go to work because it's always such a lovely sight and so attractive to a human being to gaze on our own world.
And do you also get a sense of the fragility of life? First of all, the atmosphere is extremely thin, and yet it's like the skin of an apple, and yet it creates life on the planet Earth. not to mention the fact that the Earth is suspended in this rather hostile environment of cosmic rays and potential meteor impacts. So do you get a feeling of the fragility of humanity that we are, quote-unquote, on spaceship Earth?
You certainly get a sense that the Earth is a varied and delicate place. You see immense variety in color and in texture as you travel around the planet once every 90 minutes. Looking at the Earth's horizon, you can see this thin blanket of the atmosphere. You can look down at night and watch meteors burning up in it below you. And you can see the air glow layer high in the atmosphere against the dark night full of stars. So it's aesthetically beautiful, and you're aware of how thin that envelope of air is in particular. I found that you wanted to get to these thousands of places on Earth that you could see, that the rainforests, the glaciers, the high mountain peaks, the river valleys. You wanted to go personally to all of these places to learn more about the planet, and yet you realize as a human being you're never going to live long enough to go to all of these places that you've seen from orbit. I felt a great attraction and sense of longing in my heart to be part of Earth, and I felt separated from it to some extent, especially thinking that I was half a world away from my family most of the time. But generally, I had this great attraction for this lovely planet of ours, and I can't imagine what the Apollo astronauts must have experienced traveling 1,000 miles farther away in space than I did. And it was so strong for me, I'm sure that they must have had a great longing to get back.
Okay, now let's talk about the downside of being in outer space. For example, the Russians set the world's record for being in outer space on one mission, being lofted into space for over a year. And when that cosmonaut came back down to Earth, he could barely crawl. He was almost like a worm. The atrophy of the muscles was so great that he could not stand up. And so let's talk about the fact that when you're in space, you have enormous muscle and bone loss.
Short-term space flight doesn't present many problems. We exercised every couple of days while we were in space. The longest trip I had was 18 days. And so if you do a medium amount of exercise for an hour every other day, you're going to keep your heart, lungs, and muscles in good enough shape to do any physical task that's required and also to withstand reentry. And then you can sort of stagger off the space shuttle and get your land legs under you just as you were coming back from a long sea voyage. And within about a half an hour, you can walk under your own steam with no great worries. You feel heavy at first when you come back to Earth. That passes in about an hour. The longest effect that I felt was about 3 days of lacking a fine sense of motor balance. So I couldn't bend over from the waist and pick up a penny on the floor. That would have just toppled me over. I had to wait until my brain became used to using those inner ear balance organs again, and it took about 3 days for those to come back online. Now, for space station astronauts, like my friend Bill MacArthur, who's headed back to Earth on April 8th here, he's been up there for more than 6 months, and he's been exercising every day for 90 minutes. He's been using both a treadmill and an exercise bike and a resistive exercise device that allows him to do the equivalent of lifting weights up there. And by combining those forms of exercise, his muscle and cardiac health will be in pretty good shape when he comes home. So I think he'll be able to walk within about an hour. He's got the benefit of a lot of experience since that Russian mission 16 or 17 years ago. He'll be able to be more mobile when he comes back. He will have, however, some loss of calcium from his skeleton. He's lost some bone mass. Some of that will recover back on Earth. He'll probably have a permanent deficit of a few percent. And, of course, we don't know the long-term repercussions of that. So while he's going to get some professional physical rehabilitation, I think he'll have no short-term ill effects, and it'll only be in the later decades of his life that he finds out whether he's got skeletal weakening that's of any consequence. It doesn't appear to be a long-term effect for these six-month space station missions. But as you understand, Mars missions are an open question.
And we should also point out that a mission to Mars has a host of other problems. First of all, Mars itself is a frozen desert. For the most part, temperatures barely rise above the melting point of ice. And so most of the time, Mars is frozen over. Second of all, atmospheric pressure is only 1% atmospheric pressure on the planet Earth. And the atmosphere is basically carbon dioxide. So you would choke if you were to try to breathe the Martian air, not to mention the fact that your blood would boil and basically you might even explode as a consequence of the low pressure on the planet Mars. And then to top it off, you have to worry about radiation from outer space.
That's why one NASA official has stated that perhaps we should have our astronauts live in caves, lava tubes, ancient lava tubes left over from volcanic activity on the planet Mars would be an ideal place for our astronauts to live in order to avoid being irradiated by radiation from outer space, and also micrometeorites. And then to top it off, we have also the problem of rocket failure and mishaps. Realize that about 1% of the time, our rockets do not perform as expected and, in fact, blow up. If you take a look at the fatality rate of the space program, it's about a little over 1%. So 1% of the time, you don't come back. In fact, Mars has something called the Mars Jinx. The Mars Jinx basically means that about 3/4 of the time, unmanned missions to Mars simply don't make it because of rocket failure, explosions, because of miscalculations, because the Mars probe crashes on the surface of Mars, any number of reasons why we have the Mars Jinx. So again, it's possible. Yes, we could send people to Mars, but I think that we have to be very careful when it comes to shooting human life out to the red planet. So, in other words, we do not have to initiate a crash program to divert the world economy to create space arcs to colonize the red planet. No. No one's talking about that. We have plenty of problems here on the planet Earth, like global warming and inequalities to worry about. No, we're talking about in the long haul. We need an insurance policy, a settlement that's self-sufficient, that's not a drain on the world economy. A settlement that could be an insurance policy in case something bad does happen to the planet Earth. And as costs keep dropping like a rock, and as more private and public funds are invested into our future in space, it becomes a real reality, a self-sustaining settlement on another world that does not drain the world economy. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.